The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I'm Gianluca Giuffrida. I work for the IT department of the Vatican Apostolic Library. And today I will talk to you about our digitization project. Okay, so let's start. Okay, the year is 3021. A lot of things happened. Some really bad things happened in there. And so we lost a lot of memory of our past. You are a researcher. Let's make this imaginary experiment. You work on ancient ruins, and you found three data devices. Let's make some simple assumption to move on with more speed. The assumptions are that you understand the concept of bit and byte, you understand the concept of file, and you know at least in part the ASCII encoding. None of these are mandatory. We can remove these assumptions and and everything will work in any case, but let's assume this just to go quickly. What is the ASCII encoding? You probably already know. Anyway, the ASCII encoding is a way to go from a group of 8 bit or 1 byte to one character. It's one of the more oldest encoding in informatics, translation between bytes and something else. Okay, with just these three simple assumptions, you start to mine the data device to find something. You are looking for some discovery. This is the first device. You can see here the hexadecimal code of your file. Essentially, this is the file naked, without any sort of structure, any software that can read the file. And you can see here the ASCII encoding, the only encoding that you know to try to understand what kind of file it is. And you can see if you don't have any information about the format of the file, you cannot tell many things. You can read the MM here, image A, and a little less. So you take these files, this device, you send to a decryption laboratory, and you go on with the next device. The next device is not so much better. You cannot read more JFIF here, but nothing more. So you cannot understand what this device contains, and you send to another laboratory. And finally, the third device, that of course is the device of the Vatican Apostolic Library. Here you can see a lot of things. You can see a lot of characters, and you can understand something. If you understand English, this is much clearer. If you don't understand English, you can notice a pattern, some number that repeat, and so on. So first of all, you can notice that you seem to have blocks of length 80. So try to format this with a length of 80 columns, and that's what you obtain. These are clear couple of key values. It's a sort of dictionary, it's something that is telling you some value of some keys. And if you understand English, you can see that there are pixel length of data axis. You can quickly understand that this is an image, actually. If you don't know English, you can notice that there are numbers, and you can try to understand what this number represents. And you can read the Bibliotheca Apostolica Vaticana, that perhaps it tells you something, at least I hope that. So you can see a lot of information here. But then there is something else that it makes no sense in ASCII codification, so you stop. But let's see what you have. You point to the smaller file, because it's easy to analyze. So it's a little file, 43,000 bytes, more or less. You see that the first 2,880 bytes looks in ASCII codification. So you put this number apart. You can see that the last 320 bytes are all zeros, so they look like some filling, not something that contains information. Then you stay with 40,000 bytes that you don't know what they contain. Perhaps you understand that this is an image, and perhaps you notice that if you multiply an axis 1 per an axis 2, you obtain exactly this size. So, I will make it brief. Let's try to format the hexadecimal code with a length of column of 200, skipping the first bytes in ASCII. This is what you obtain. This is clearly an image. If you say it, the full image is this. This is just hexadecimal code, it's not an image. You can clearly understand that this is an image. You can now think about this key value, color map BW. Perhaps it's telling something you about the coloring of the image. BW could stand for black and white. You can try to make some attempts, but you can quickly obtain this. It's the logo of the Vatican Apostolic Library. So let's stop for a moment. With simple assumption, without any knowledge of the format that actually is the FITS file format, I will talk a bit about this in the next slides, you could understand that this is an image, you can open it, and now you can see what there is inside. Yes? No, not exactly, because if you decode this portion assigning black or white at the two hexadecimal value that we find here, you obtain this image. So it's not exactly ASCII art. Actually, you can recognize the figure because this is a simple image, just black and white, just a few pixels. But it will work also with more complex figure. You will see here, for example, you point to the second smaller files, and you can see a structure very similar to the other file, but there is something different in this value of column map. Now it's RGB. You probably don't understand what this means, but you notice that there are three copies of your images, apparently. So perhaps you make some attempts, perhaps someone tell you, well, RGB could be red, green, and blue, actually was quite used in the past as a codification of color. So you try to assign red, green, and blue value to these pixels, and now it's not just black and white. Red, green, blue value could have values that go from 0 to 255, so a gradation. And you obtain this. Of course, this works because this is an unlikely contrasted image. But, and you can see nicely in hexadecimal, but the principle is the same. Now you understand that the image, this device contains a lot of images, that this image is in this format, and you have these three blocks, and you have to interpret this as a red, green, and blue signal. So you open all the other files, and what you find is a lot of wonders. You find what it is the digital corpus of the Vatican Apostolic Library, our digital images of our manuscript. You find a lot of treasures. So let's start with the real talk. This was just a simple joke that I make with you. I hope you appreciated it. Now, I will talk about the library. So, an outline, what is the Vatican Apostolic Library, what we have, why it is important to preserve what we have in the library. I will talk about our digitization project, our digitization workflow. You will see how you process the manuscript. And finally, what we are doing with these images. Okay, what is the Vatican Library? The Vatican Library is essentially the library of the Pope, but it's open also to scholars that want to work there and study what we have. It's located in here. We are inside the Vatican City. This is, you probably recognize St. Peter, St. Peter Square. It's in here, in the Cortile del Belvedere, it's called here. If you know the Vatican Museum, that is the Vatican Museum. And the library is located in here, but we have also warehouse that go through there. It's quite a beautiful place. It's quite ancient. It was founded in the 15th century. There are a lot of arts and history in these buildings. Just a little second of picture to show to you. This one, a portion of one of the warehouse. We have six floors like this one, with more than almost 2 million books. So, a bit of history. The Vatican Library was founded by Nicholas V, that he was a great humanist. He appreciated a lot the ancient books. With the books that he acquired for himself, he created the first Vatican Library. He also could take advantage of the fall of Constantinople in that year that allow him to acquire a lot of books of people that were running away from Turks. His project was completed at 624, that found officially the library in this date. And an important thing to know is that the Vatican Library is not a religious library, not only at least. It's a library that contains all kinds of books for all kinds of scholars. This is, for example, a sentence of Benedict XVI that was talking about the library. No? Okay, today the Vatican preserves a lot of content, 80,000 manuscripts that go from the first, second century after Christ to these days. We have a lot of printed books, incunabula that are the first printed books, so 15th and 16th century. We have a lot of coins and medals that go from the Greek city to the Roman Republic, Roman Empire, of course a lot of papal coins and medals, but we have also print, drawings, engravings, photographs. We preserve a lot of things. And I will now go through some of our most beautiful treasure, just to show to you what we have. This, for example, my personal favorite, the Virgilius Vaticanus. It contains fragments of Virgil's Aeneid and Georgics. We have 72 pages, but when it was written, it should contain more or less 400 pages. So a lot of pages have been lost in time. It was written around 400 AD. To make you understand why this is so important, let's see how was the world, and the Roman world in particular, in these days. It was not a good place. You probably already know. Let's hear the direct witness of the time, starting with Ammianus Marcellinus, a Roman soldier, historian, and protector domesticus. That means it was a soldier that worked directly for the emperor, a sort of secret agent, if you want. So he knows a lot of this society. He travels a lot. And this is how he described Rome just a few years before the 400 AD. It's a place where the culture is dying, essentially. Libraries are shut up forever like tombs. is talking here about probably private libraries, not public libraries. But we know also that of the 28 public libraries of the Roman, the Imperial Rome, just a few were still open at that time. Most of them were closed. Just a few years later, Saint Jerome, Latin priest, theologian, and historian, he sent a lot of letters, and we have all the letters. And in 409, he described a tragic scenario in the Roman Empire. Rome has to fight within her own borders, not for glory, but for bare life. If Rome be lost, where shall we look for help? And then Rome is taken by the gods and sacked. And it's tragic. Saint Jerome is desperate. The city which had taken the whole world was itself taken. So it was there were difficult times, very, very difficult times. And there were people like Quintus Aurelius Symmachus in that time, a Roman senator, orator, and man of letters. Quintus Aurelius Symmachus, together with other pagan aristocrats, but also Christian ones, they were understanding that the classical culture was falling. They started to lose pieces. They want to preserve that, to save what could be saved. Of course, they didn't understand that the empire was falling. But they understand that something was changing and it was dramatic. So they started to copy and preserve books. And the Vatican Latinus, the Virgilius Vaticanus that I showed to you, is one of the books that was produced by Symmachus or by one of their friends, their elite of aristocrats that was trying to save classical culture. All this scenario that I described to you, probably you already know that, but as a lover of science fiction, it probably sounds quite familiar because it's exactly what Asimov described in Foundation, the Foundation Cycle. In Foundation Cycle, we have a huge empire that is falling. Few people understand that and try to save their legacy, their culture, their knowledge. And I will mention here just three snapshots from the last Foundation trailer. The empire is dying, only we can shorten the darkness. We can save ourselves, but we can save our legacy. I have no idea how will be the TV series, but I really like the book, so I think that it was worth mentioning it. So essentially, it's the same story. Asimov was largely inspired by the fall of the Roman Empire in Widening Foundation. And a piece of the legacy that was saved, we have in the library. Legacy of the Roman Empire, not the Empire of the Foundation, of course. Then, add some other pieces of wonders that we have. The Anna Papyrus. Anna Papyrus is the oldest fragment of the New Testament. It contains the oldest version of the Pater Noster, and it's in here. Then, the Codex Borgia. It is a Mesoamerican ritual and divinatory manuscript, and it is one of the few pieces that was saved after the destruction of the pre-Columbian society in South America. A lot of knowledge has been lost in that days. And we have a little piece of that. And then I'm an astronomer, as you probably, as you perhaps know if you read the guide. And I'm particularly fascinated by these two books. Are books written by Ptolemy, one of the great astronomers of ancient time. Ptolemy was an astronomer of the second century after Christ. He summarized the work of many astronomers before him. And we have two of the oldest copies of his work, copied around the 9th century. They contain the oldest information about the sky that we have precise, with the deception of some Babylonian inscription, but that's another story. And it's funny to observe that I'm working now with the oldest map of our universe. But as an astronomer, I'm also involved with the European Space Agency Gaia mission that is making now the best map of the universe ever made. So it's funny to know that I'm working with the oldest and the newest map of the universe at the same time. Okay, well, that's just to show you the datation of the manuscript that we have. You can see that we have hundreds of books written before the year 1000. And you can also observe that if you sum all this, we have the datation of just about 10,000 manuscripts, over 80,000. There is a lot of work still to do. And we have digitized now about 20,000 manuscripts, so only one on two have have information about when the mask was produced. That's because there are a lot of material to study and there are not enough scholars, and up to a few years ago it was quite difficult to access our books, especially the oldest one. But now we are digitizing it, it is more easier, and I will show to you how to read our book now. So, what the library does? What are the rules and responsibilities of the libraries? Essentially, we can summarize it in three words: preserve, study, disseminate. We must preserve what we have for future generation. We must study it to understand better the history of the humanity. We must disseminate that to allow other people to study and admire what we have. Well, it's not adequate, I think, because we have a lot of pagan books, or books that are quite not religious, so it would be a bit funny to talk about evangelize. I like admire. So, to reach also these three goals, we are digitizing the entire library of manuscripts, and also we start to digitize printed books after that. Digitization project started in 2012. Up to now, more or less 6 million pages have been digitized, more or less 21,000 books. We're using the FITS format. I will describe a bit in deeper details now, but you already see that in the little experiment that we made at the beginning of the talk. And we have now 400 terabytes of FITS, more or less. But our whole archive, including TIFF file, auxiliary file, counts about 1.5 petabytes, so quite a large archive. At the end of the digitization of just the manuscript, we will have 1.6 petabytes of FITS, but this number will grow because we want to preserve also raw images, that is the signal. Yes? No, we have our own server. It's all on-premise because then we share it, and I will show you the website in a moment, but we want to take everything in the Vatican. We use, in particular, at the moment, EMC Isilon, that is quite a beautiful system for storing digital objects. But this number will grow, I was saying, because we want to preserve also raw images, that is, are the original signal captured by the camera, and we are also making multi-frequency images in most for a lot of pages. I will show to you in a moment. That means that for each page you don't take one picture, you take 10, 20 or 30 pictures for one image with different information. So this number will certainly grow. Why do we use the FITS format? I think that you already know the answer from the little experiment that we make at the beginning. A FITS file is quite easy to read. A researcher in the future could easily understand how to read the file without any knowledge. But let's go in some more details. The Library of Congress detailed the 7 factors that a format should satisfy to be good for long-term data preservation, these 7. Most of them are quite obvious. There has to be no patents, no technical protection, that obviously you want to preserve this, you don't want to have some technical protection mechanism that can obstruct the reading of the file in the future. We don't want any external dependency. We want something that is already adopted, you don't want to build from scratch a new format that perhaps no one will use. The FITS format is widely used in astronomy. That's why, if you're wondering, an astronomer like me is working for them, because I'm quite acknowledged with the format. I will concentrate a bit on these two, transparency and safe documentation, because in my opinion, they are quite important. Safe documentation essentially is the ability that the file has to contain everything needed to open and use the file. You already saw that. With just the ASCII encoding, we had to send how to open the files. Going into some more details, a basic FITS is composed by two components, header and data. Header is the part in ASCII. So you have a block of 2,880 bytes. If you remember, we already met this number, just analyzing the file. Each block contains 36 couple of key and value that describe the file and give you instruction on how to open the file. And then the data part contains the image. In this case, you can put image of on. We opened together an image of 8-bit for color channel, but you can contain 16, 32, 64 bit if you want, and you can make image of the number of dimension that you want. Actually, the image, the color image that we opened before is a three-dimensional image, X, Y, and color. Color is the third dimension. But you can also put three-dimensional image in four dimension to have the color, and so on. You can move on. This block header data is called HDU, header data unit. The beautiful thing of it is that you can replicate this structure and attach more header data unit in a single file, so you can have a single file fits containing many images, not just one. Just to make an experiment, I created a file fits with 22,000 images, and I stopped just because I reached the 500 gigabytes of my disk, but I can go on. And it's quite easy to manage such a large file. I will show it to you in a moment. And you can also put inside the file a relation between the HDU. An HDU could be parent of another HDU. An HDU could have more than one parent, so you can also establish complicated relationships between HDU. For example, you can create a large fixed file containing images of a books, pages of a books, that have as a father the books itself, that has as a father the shelf in which it contains the books, and so on. You can create something complicated. Actually, with fixed file, you don't even need a file system, because you can create one large file that fills all your space, and it's perfectly lazy for the format. And that's for self-documentation. For transparency, I will not go into details. If you're interested, we can go. It's quite simple. But anyway, knowing the X, Y coordinates of the points that you are interested, you can point directly to the bytes that contain that points. That's a huge advantage in image analysis, because if you want to locate just some portion of the images, you can quickly retrieve them just pointing at the right bytes without opening the whole file. This is why you can have also a fixed file of 500 gigabytes of or terabytes of fixed file, and you can point just what you need, and this is so quick. And so you understand how transparent is the format. It's all there. It's nothing is masked or encrypted. It's all there. You can read it. It's easy. How we work in the digitization workflow. So the books, the ancient books, are preserved in a bunker underground. It's a direct underground of the libraries. It's a bunker very resistant, and the temperature and humidity are fixed at the optimal point to preserve the books, and we try to put the books out of this bunker as less time as possible. When you want to digitize a book, the book go out, go in the conservation workshop, that is a laboratory where the books are analyzed and see if they are in good shape. The conservation workshop must say if the book can be digitized or not. Because if it's too fragile, it must be restored before digitization. If it's okay, you can send to the scanner, and you can also tell, this book is too fragile, don't open 180 degrees, so open 130, for example, because if you open too much, you could ruin it. So with this specification, you go to the scanner acquires the images. The images is checked by a human being, the first tutor is called, that see if the image is good enough to change page. But not only, he waits for the approval of another human being in a different room that see immediately the image, and tell, okay, that's good enough, change page. And only then you change the page. You want to touch as little as possible the manuscript. Then at the end of the process, and then the acquisition of a single book, there is a third person, a super tutor, that a different person, of not one of the other two, that check all the images of the book and tell, okay, the digitization is good enough, take the book, put back in the conservation workshop, that they will see if the book has been damaged during the process, and they will restore the books, and they put back in the bunker. Then, after this first validation by human beings, the file are validated by machine. We have protocols for validating the TIFF file obtained by the scanner, And if a file is validated, then it's converted in FITS, that is our long-term data reservation format, and then put in the two different locations, physically separated. And so yes, we do backup. I don't know if you remember this episode of Star Trek The Original Series, that's Memory Alpha, a planet that is a big library of the Federation. Enterprise go there in the episode 18 of the third season of The Original Series, and well, a lot of things happen. I won't tell you the whole episode, but what's it's funny to see that Spock realizes that the memory core is burned out, so everything is lost. Then we realize that the Federation of Planets use an entire planet to make a huge library and do not make backups. Okay. And finally, when you put the book in the long-term data preservation archive, in the meantime, you put it on the web. This is the website. If you want, you can go there. You can read the whole 20,000 manuscript already digitized. The whole content is there online. It's free to see. Please go after. And for the technician of you, the one that works with web, we use the IIIF protocol. I don't know if you know that. It's a protocol to share images on the web. It's quite powerful. With a simple API, you can share images of different resolution. And just with API, you can call a portion of the images. You can rotate the images. You can do a lot of things. It's quite powerful. And so using this protocol, we have this website where you can see our images. So basically what we are doing is going through from a shelf mark that is a unique identifier that locates the book on the library to an URI that is unique URI that locates the manuscript on the web now. And this is permanent. We try to never change that. We change that only if something really it's really important happens that we have to change it. Otherwise, this will stay stable in the next years. Okay. So, a bit of fun now with image analysis, because for now we talk about the preserve and disseminate. Through digitization, we are preserving the books, because we are preserving a digital copy, and there is no need to put out of the bunker the original manuscript. So basically you are preserving also the original book because you keep it in the bunker. But let's see the study part. What you are doing with the digital analysis, I will show to you that the digitization of the library is enabling us to make some very, very peculiar research. I will talk to you about two arguments. The analysis of palimpsests and the quantitative codicology. Just a few words, don't worry. What is a palimpsest? A palimpsest is not the one of the television. A palimpsest is a parchment that has been deleted and rewritten. Why that? First of all, what is a parchment? A parchment is the skin of an animal, essentially. In the late Roman Empire and during the medieval ages, they use the skin of cow, goats, sheep to obtain the parchment they use to write books. So it was quite expensive. To produce one book, so you have to kill many animals. It was quite expensive, and they try to use as better as possible the parchment. If you have old books that you don't read anymore, you don't need anymore, you can try to wash away the ink and rewrite with the new books that you find more interesting. The point is that what is interesting changes in time. So a lot of knowledge of the past, a lot of books has been lost because the parchment has been deleted and rewritten. And you can see that there is something down there because it's not completely deleted, but it's quite difficult to read. In some cases, especially in the 19th century, people tried to apply chemical compound to the manuscript to delete the upper text and enhance the lower text. This works. For example, Angelo May in the Vatican Library recovered the whole the Republica of Cicero in this way. But in some cases, it had tragic results. For example, these pages became completely black. You can see almost anything in here. And also illuminating in ultraviolet, you can see practically anything. And why this is important? Why it is so important, this page? What should contain the palimpsest below? Should contain a text of Polybius. Polybius write history books in the second century before Christ. And what is particularly interesting is that Polybius was a direct witness of the Third Punic War, the war in which Carthago was destroyed. And so it's important to recover what he was writing because he was a direct witness of the events. And we know from later author that in this page it should be one of these two episodes that we don't have in original, but just a re-narration of later author. The first piece we miss is Scipio that with Polybius observe the ruins of Carthago and cries thinking about how tragic it is that a city so big and so powerful fall and now there are just ruins and cry thinking about the same destiny that could come for Rome in the future. The second episode that it could be in this page is the death of the wife of Asdrubal. Asdrubal was the general that was defending Carthago. He surrendered himself to Romans. The wife was so shamed by this movement of the husband that killed herself with the two children in the fire of the city. So what can you do with a digital image of this page? You can try to illuminate the page with lamps of different wavelength, and you will obtain for each wavelength some little details in some little portion of the pages. Then you can combine everything with what is called the principal component analysis. And finally, I don't know if you can see, but it's quite readable now. You can obtain something that became readable from a page that looks completely dark in the original image. So this is the work of a colleague of mine, András Németh, an expert on Greek palimpsest. And now you can read the portion. He's still working on it. It will be published in a few months, I think. But in a few months, you can go to your favorite bookshop, buy the histories of Polybius, and you will have a new page after centuries that page was lost. It's a drop on the ocean of the knowledge that humanity has lost in the past. But again, it's a drop more. Okay, now another quick example of principal component analysis. This is not made by the Vatican Library, but just to show you the same technique. You can see a text, black, that is the upper text. And you can see that there is something below, a red text that is quite difficult to read. Again, with multi-wavelength analysis of the page and principal component, now you can see that the text that was red and difficult to read before is now black. And it's, for an expert, it's quite easy to read now. You can recover its content. So in this way, we are recovering a lot of knowledge that was lost in the past. Okay, last argument, and then I will free you, don't worry. I'm really fascinated by codicology. Codicology is the study of a book as an object, as an archaeological object. The idea is you study a book like you study the Colosseum or some ancient ruin. So you study its material aspect of the book. And quantitative codicology, in particular, analyze the single page and extract a series of numbers from the page. The numbers are the space of the written part, the space of the victorious path, the sides of the page, the number of text columns, text lines, the ratio between full and empty space, the parchment in colors. Why this is important? It is important because in ancient times, parchment was quite expensive, as I said. So when people started to write books, they must know exactly where to write to not waste parchment. So the page was divided before writing in space for the written part, space for the pictorial. Also lines were traced on the parchment to allow writing without waste parchment. All this process is called mise en page in technical way. And the way to prepare the page was different in different epoch and in different location. Each copyist center has its own style. So basically, studying the number that came out from this analysis, you can find at least an hint of where and when the books were produced. And this is particularly fascinating for me because I'm a physicist and an astronomer. I love books, I love history, but I'm not an expert. It's not my job to study books in the normal way that is see at the material and other things. But this kind of sense transforms each page in a series of numbers, and I can understand the number. I can find correlation with the numbers. I can find aggregation. That's my job. That's always been my job. So I'm dedicating a lot of effort on this particular science now at the library. So, last slide. Okay, concluding what you can do with the digitized images. You can unveil something that was hidden from the history, and you can also find where and when books were written, so helping to understand the history of books, and at the end to understand our history, because the history of the books is our history, history of our society. Okay, that's all. I hope that you enjoy it. If you have any question, I'm here. Too fast, eh? Yes.
Ratios are shifting slowly from one ratio, for example, to another.
Yes.
So only studying the ratio, you can say, okay, this pertains to this age.
You can have an hint at least. Perhaps it's not enough to delimitate the books to a certain period, but it's an hint that combining with other hints can tell you definitely where and when the books were written. Yes. Well, you can see, an expert can see the style in which the books is written, because the style, the way in the shape of the letters change a lot in time. For example, in the late Roman Empire, if you remember the Vigilio Vaticanus, they use a style that is similar to the one that you can find in engravings around Rome. So it's capital letter that are quite easy to understand for us. Then they started to write in different styles. For example, you have to get the Gothic style, that is a way to compact a lot of text, put the letter near together, and make lines very, very short to put more text. Yes, essentially, looking at the shape of the cartels, you can have an idea on when the book was written. Then you can see at the parchment. You can study in the parchment. You can understand more or less how old it is. There is a lot of centering, but it can give you an idea. You can make DNA studies of the parchment, understand what kind of animals it was. For example, if you find that it's a cow, and you know that in that monastery they do not use cow, they use just sheep, you can exclude that monastery. And so on, you have to put together all the pieces. And at the end, you can understand when, not only when the books were written, but also what happens to the books in the future, because you can also find annotations quite later. So you can understand that the books stayed, for example, 100 for one century in another place, but then move, and you can reconstruct the history of the book, understand what happens to him, to it.
Like the time that leaves the layers of the story.
Yes. That is basically exactly what what archaeologists made with the Colosseum, for example. They understand the different restoration process that the Colosseum that was made on the Colosseum during time and so on. You reconstruct the whole history of the monuments. And that's the idea. The book is a monument that you have to study as an object that is evolving in time. And it is still evolving. Because, for example, we have all the picture of books made in the 50s or 60s, so 70 years ago, more or less. And in some cases, cases, they are much worse picture than the picture they were doing now. But in some cases, you can see in that picture some characters that now are no more present because they have been deleted by some accident or whatever other reason. So in some cases, in this case, we are trying also to recover that old picture and preserve also that. And making picture distant in time, you can understand how the book is evolving. Because continuously the ink is a little deleting, a little deteriorating. So it's important to make as many pictures as possible of the books, also to study their evolution in time. Oh, well, that's a good question. Both of them. We have a lot of people inside the library. I would say it's difficult to count a number because in many aspects, almost each worker of the library is involved in one aspect or another. And there are about 120 workers on the Vatican Library. But we have also collaboration with several realities. For example, Seret and Bibionova collaborate with us and give us personnel to scan the books, to check the quality of the images and so on. So a lot of people are involved. I would say at least 100. Consider that more or less, considering the cost of the people, the cost of the scanner, the cost of restoration and so on, the scan one page has a cost of about €1. So 6 million pages has costed more or less 6 million euros. That's the idea. Putting all together, of course. Okay, if you have any other questions, quite soon we can go on. Anyway, you will find me around the next days, so come to me and ask questions if you want. I'm here. I'm glad to share my work. Okay.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificast.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Allarme rosso, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
85%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6, posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 è pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 è posizionato.
Un'energia terrificante.
Yeah.